I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. President Ronald Reagan once referred to Libya's Colonel Gaddafi as the mad dog of the Middle East. Well, a couple of weeks back, President George Bush was congratulating Gaddafi, calling his judgment wise and responsible, a man who knows the way forward. Talk about a political transformation. In recent years, Libya's leader has accepted responsibility for the airline bombing that killed 270 people over Lockerbie. He has joined the U.S. war on terror by sharing information with America. And now Gaddafi has publicly announced and renounced his country's nuclear weapons program. The Bush administration is saying it will proceed cautiously in embracing the colonel. He has yet to be invited to the ranch. But Bush's people say this is further proof that its wars in Afghanistan and Iraq are bringing transformation to the Middle East. And so, how far should the United States go in rewarding Libya? Can Gaddafi be made an example to other leaders like those in Iran or North Korea? Can the thugs of one era really become the angels of another? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're going to hear two very different perspectives on what to make of the new Libya in just a moment. First, though, to Scott Anderson. Scott is a writer whose work recently included a profile of Colonel Gaddafi in the New York Times magazine. And Scott's joining us from New York. Scott, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
In your profile of Gaddafi, did you get a sense of whether or not this is a man who is still in charge in Libya?
Oh, absolutely. I think his control of Libya is still pretty much absolute. You certainly got a sense of all the people around him. They looked to him for guidance. He seemed very much in charge of everything that was going on.
I mean, he does say to you in the piece that he has no responsibility for day-to-day governance of Libya, that he's rather a spiritual leader with no official powers.
Right. I think this is kind of a fiction that's been created in Libya to give him some political cover over events of the past few years. A little bit of distance from the Lockerbie bombing. And probably even now with the disclosure of the weapons of mass destruction program, Gaddafi has this position where he can, it's like he doesn't really know precisely what's going on.
Which gives him the opportunity to make these sort of radical transformations?
That's right.
So did you come away from your meeting with him believing that he's really sincere in his desire to transform both himself and his country to genuinely renounce terrorism?
Well, it's interesting, the whole issue of terrorism. And I think one thing that needs to be stated here is that Gaddafi has always been an enemy of Islamic fundamentalists. He has been at war with them ever since he came to power. So he has always seen the Al Qaeda and fundamentalist groups as his enemy. So the idea that some people get across is that when after September 11th, that Gaddafi just sort of saw which way the wind was blowing and jumped ships is really not accurate at all. If anything, he saw this as an opportunity. This was his wedge to get back in with the United States, something he's been trying to do for a long time because, as he said immediately after September 11th, we have a common front, we have a common enemy. And that's clearly been the case. He has seen that as his primary enemy, the Islamic fundamentalists, for 20, 30 years.
But his definition of terrorism isn't necessarily the one shared by the Bush administration. I mean, he still considers himself to have been a victim of U.S. terrorism with the Reagan bombing in 1986, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it gets to the whole sort of squishy definition of what is terrorism. He certainly sees himself as a target of terrorism in the past from the United States.
Scott, in the time that you spent in the country, did you get any idea that the people in Libya either like the leader or fear the leader or respect the leader?
Oddly, all of the above. I think probably the other world leader that closely resembles Gaddafi in relationship with his people is probably Fidel Castro of Cuba. There is not a climate of some fear or reservation, certainly not like terror that you had Iraq. Libyans will talk rather openly to a foreigner about the silly or stupid things that Gaddafi has done in the past. At the same time, there is this reservoir of affection and respect for him. And I think part of that, a large measure of that, stems from the very fact that they see Gaddafi as a man who has stood up to the rest of the world and who has put Libya on the map. So I think there is quite a complicated relationship that the people have towards him.
And when you look at that man in his country, is it your assessment that his desire to make this transformation is based on a need to improve the economic circumstances or to change his own political circumstances, his own legacy? What would you mark there?
I would mark it more as political. Economically, with the lifting of the UN sanctions, Libya is doing quite well. A lot of European companies are in there. They're in the oil exploration is taking place all over the country. Huge construction projects. I think that what Gaddafi was always most concerned about is some reaction from the United States, political or militarily. Immediately after September 11th, there was, and in fact for the year afterwards, there was a lot of talk among the hawks in the Bush administration that once they dealt with Iraq, Libya was going to be next. I think Gaddafi certainly, caught wind of those proposals and thought, this is the time to kind of make everything right.
Scott, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Dick.
Scott Anderson is author of a feature article in New York Times Magazine 1 year ago. It was called The Makeover, and it featured Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, leader in Libya. We're going to turn now to Mansour El-Kikieh. He is a Libyan dissident and associate professor of political science at the University of Texas in San Antonio. Thanks for being with us, sir.
Thank you very much.
And Ambassador David Mack is joining us. He has worked in Libya and is a former U.S. ambassador to the United Arab Emirates. Ambassador Mack is currently vice president of the Middle East Institute. He's joining us from Washington. Ambassador Mack, thanks for taking the time.
Good morning, Dick.
Let me start with you, if I can, Ambassador, because you were an American diplomat in Libya at the time when Gaddafi seized power all the way back in 1969. Am I right about that?
That's correct.
So you've seen this man and watched him and listened to his railing against the United States and his harboring of terrorism and the recent transformation. This is a man who, for many of us, personifies the country. We see Libya as Gaddafi's country. Are we right to see it that way?
No, not really. In many respects, the Libyan national character is very different from Gaddafi's own personality. To a very significant degree, he provided a major departure from what I think would have been the normally pragmatic and cautious course that Libyan leaders would have taken. In that respect, he was very much of a revolutionary that tried to drag his country along a certain path, certain paths, since he changed his course from time to time. I think the thing that has to be noted about Muammar Gaddafi, and I speak personally here, because when I met him and was in meetings with him, both he and I were under 30. I don't know about you, but almost 35 years later, there's been a lot of changes in my life. I like to think that I'm wiser, that I'm more mature, that I've got better sense. Frankly, I would disassociate myself from some of the remarks that have been attributed to President Bush and others, that there was a change of heart. Somehow he's turned from a thug to an angel. I'd settle for somebody who is more sensible, more cautious, more aware of the international restraints on what Libya as a nation can accomplish, more aware of what Libya as a nation needs, and also much more aware of his own personal mortality and his own personal limitations. And I think to a very great degree, I see this kind of change having taken place in Gaddafi.
So you're taking him at his word when he says, these are my opinions today. You're not among those who says, yeah, what will your opinions be tomorrow?
No, I'm not taking him at his word. It's not a question of trusting anybody. It's a question of setting up some kind of framework for what I might call conditional engagement. When you very carefully test somebody's behavior and performance, you don't suddenly say, I've looked into this man's heart, as mm-hmm. President Bush might have said about Putin, I've looked into his heart and I know I can trust him. Not at all. It's much more what President Reagan said at the time of the first detente between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, that we're going to trust and verify. But the verification was the real issue. And I think that's the stage where we should be at. And I hope that that's the course that the administration is embarked on. And it does seem to me that that's the way it's moving.
Let me turn to Mansour Al-Kikia. You are teaching political science at the University of Texas, and you're a lot less confident that we're actually watching any kind of a change in the attitude of Colonel Gaddafi?
Yes, unfortunately, yes. I wish I could agree with David. I have high respect for him. But the truth is, I know the man. I know the man much more than he does, because while David and many others who study Libya look at Libya from one perspective, I see Libya as a component of many perspectives. I see the domestic, I see the international, I see the cultural, I see all that. And the truth is, even Gaddafi is saying the same thing to the Libyans that he's saying to the United States and the rest of the world, but he's not doing any changes in Libya. He's not changing the structure in Libya. In fact, I was watching him yesterday giving a speech about the legal system. And the first thing he was doing was denigrating the British system, how archaic and how bad it is. He's still talking about his system as the best system in the world. He's still talking about his system as the only system in the world. He's still talking about his system as though it's a system of human rights. I would understand David and understand the others who would say, well, this man has shown us a change, that he has become wiser. My perspective really is quite different than this. I believe that the man has been put in the place he is in after a tremendous amount of suffering to the world. It took many years to put him in the box that he's in, took many years and many lives to focus the light on the atrocities he has committed against his people and against the world. And I think that removing those restraints will in fact unleash a monster, a wiser monster, but a monster nonetheless.
All right, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, we'd like to have you join our conversation on just how far the United States and other Western countries should go in embracing Libya's leader, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, in his claim to now renounce terrorism, not necessarily new, but his new claim now to say that he's ready to open his country to full inspections on weapons of mass destruction as a way of regaining and reestablishing relations with the world. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. This hour, we're taking a look at relations in particular between the United States and Libya, and also taking the temperature of what's going on in that North African country as Colonel Muammar Gaddafi makes his bid to regain his place in the community of nations. With us on the program today, Ambassador David Mackey's Vice President of the Middle East Institute, joining us from Washington. Mansour Al-Kikia is with us. He is an Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas in San Antonio. And Ambassador, let me come back to you and with a question about what exactly the United States ought to do. I'm not sure if I got my notes right here, but rather than some kind of full normalization of relations, you're talking about a conditional engagement of types?
Yes. I'm not for jumping all the way as the government of the United Kingdom and other governments have done certainly since the lifting of the UN sanctions, and they established full diplomatic relations, full trading relations. Frankly, I think that this would be quite premature. Mm-hmm. Let's start, Dick, by what the U.S. has to gain from this, because we essentially are operating on the same policy toward Libya we've had since 1986. It's a policy that only began to bear fruit, only began to succeed when we were able to internationalize that and turn that into a UN sanctions program so that we had the leverage of the world community with us. And then we did modify Libyan behavior. We may not have changed Libya, Gaddafi's heart. Mm-hmm. We may not have turned him from a devil to an angel or made him necessarily sincere, but we certainly changed their behavior. And in international politics, you sometimes have to settle for behavior rather than a change of heart. But now it's the U.S. that would be isolated, not Libya, since you no longer have these multilateral sanctions.
So is this an economic story where U.S. oil companies are really the big losers?
Actually, I think that that's a very secondary interest. Let me tell you what the two primary interests would be in improving U.S. relations with Libya. The first is that we would set up a new paradigm for dealing with states that have been covertly developing weapons of mass destruction, chemical, nuclear, biological, and long-range missiles. We know, the nations of the world know, what happens to a nation that doesn't cooperate with us. You found that out in Baghdad. But quite frankly, there are too many bad nations trying to get bad weapons to go around the world bombing every one of them. And right now, nations that are on the fence, let's say Iran, are looking at the comparison between what happened to North Korea and what happened to Iraq. And they're saying, well, the primary difference is that the North Koreans were a lot sneakier about it and managed covertly to develop these weapons, and therefore they have a deterrence against U.S. and use of military force. And that's a very, very bad lesson to be sending to the rest of the world. Now, with Libya, finally, we may be coming up with an alternative model of how a former rogue state, a state that's been covertly trying to obtain these weapons and develop these programs, can be brought into conformity
through the use of diplomacy.
Through the use of diplomacy and through the use of very intrusive inspections with the full weight of the international community behind it. And that's a very, very good model for other countries to be seen.
Let me stop you on that one part of the model, because I think that's key to understanding what's going on. Mansour Al-Kiki, I mean, how can you argue that the type of transformation that Ambassador Mack is describing isn't the sort that will be attracting attention in these kind of on-the-fence states around the world?
I don't think so. Let me tell you why. First of all, because, I mean, the assumption here is that Mr. Gaddafi has these weapons of mass destruction in place that he gave up. Well, Mr. Gaddafi didn't give up anything. First of all, as we have seen from Mr. Al-Baradi and the delegation, the UN delegation that went to Libya, Mr. Gaddafi didn't even start. He has some yellow cake. He has some fissionable material he got from his nuclear reactor, from the research reactor the Russians gave him. He gave up nothing. He really gave up nothing. The man gave up nothing. And simultaneously, while giving up nothing, he was trying to smuggle in some centrifugal and some equipment from somewhere else.
Well, my understanding is that in giving up nothing, he has now admitted that, you know, the program was in its early stages and now it's stopped. I mean, how can you say that that's meaningless?
But again, if the program has stopped since 1988, he gave up nothing.
Let me break in here because, of course, Mansour, whom I respect greatly and who is a terrific scholar on Libya, knows very well that Libya did have chemical weapons, that it had some long-range missiles which were able to bring much of Europe, for example, within reach of those chemical warheads. So it isn't simply a nascent nuclear program that they're giving up. It's also some much more highly developed chemical weapons and missiles that they have pledged to give up.
Mansoor, quickly to you, and then we're going to go to a call.
Yeah, just quickly. First of all, we know, and you know, that the OTRAG program that he conducted during the 70s proved out to be a failure. He modified some of his Scud missiles, which couldn't even reach Lombrossa in southern Italy. He couldn't even reach that. So how can you say that he had long-range missiles to threaten all of Europe? Yes, he had some Rapta and some other chemical weapons. That is true. I agree with you. Okay, but he had, first of all, very poor delivery system. And you know that, and I know that. And he knows that. That's the whole issue. And this is why I'm saying he gave up nothing, and he got back this recognition that he's expecting.
Okay, let me stop you both there. We will talk more about this, but we have a number of people who want to join us on the phone. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going first to Buffalo, New York. John's with us. Hi, John.
Oh, good morning, Dick. Happy New Year, everyone. You know, I don't think Gaddafi wanted to find himself in a hole in Tripoli. I think that's in Libya, right? Is that in Libya? Sure.
Yeah, that's the capital. So Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think he wanted to find himself in a hole. Now, he apparently was the one who made the overtures to Tony Blair, who is one of the coalition, one of the 60 members of the coalition that is going in that liberated Iraq. So I'm trying to make the case right now that George Bush's preemptive, whatever the left wants to call it, war is actually working and bearing fruit. Now, there's no, and for all intents and purposes, Gaddafi has been in a box since Ronald Reagan whipped him, and, you know, he really has not been anything. Why does he come forth? Because he probably did have something, and he wanted to be above suspicion, because he sees what happens right now because of George Bush's reaction to despotism. And if this, if you think I'm wrong, who is going to be the first despot to really be overt and start to export weapons of mass destruction to terrorists? He's going to be the next one that's going to be found in a hole in his capital city.
So, John, when you look at the action that Libya has taken over the last 3 years, pretty well since September 11th, in terms of trying to work with the United States and with the American coalition in the war on terror, do you think that we should all take Gaddafi at his word and say, yeah, you know, this is not a short-term transformation, but this is someone who really doesn't want to risk his country being attacked?
I really don't mean to bring up Ronald Reagan, but you trust but verify. He is sort of being an open, he is sort of having an open door policy, because it is in the back of his mind, and I believe it's been stated by him that he saw what happened to Saddam Hussein, and he saw the resolve of the Americans to get rid of people who do pose harm to not only us, but really the world. And you know, I mean, to not put the two together, It really is insane to me. But I think that George Bush and his policies are working, and it's not going to be easy, and it's going to be tough at times, and there are going to be people that die. But my God, you know, our country was, how many wars did we have to fight? And we're still fighting just to preserve our freedom.
Ambassador Mack, this is the case that you were making earlier, is it not?
Well, to some degree, I certainly agree that it's far more effective to have a diplomacy that's backed up by the willingness to use force if diplomacy fails. And on the other hand, mere willingness to use force without providing a diplomatic framework almost assures that you won't be able to gain the fruits of military action. And it's been this combination of a well-established U.S. reputation going back to the mid-80s.
Can I stop you there? Because I'm not clear on what's changed. In the mid-80s, the United States bombed Gaddafi's mm-hmm. home, killed his adopted daughter.
Right.
I mean, at that time, that was a message of the use of force from the United States for somebody who wasn't willing to, follow international norms. So why is the attack on Iraq so dramatically different in terms of the message that the United States is sending?
Well, I don't think it is. And I think that the report that Scott Anderson gave at the beginning of your broadcast is really relevant here. There's been a process of change over the years as Gaddafi has begun to realize that he was headed personally and his nation was headed down a route that had no outcome save disaster for Libya and probably his own demise as a leader. That's taken place over a period of a number of years. It's taken some time for him to stop harboring some of the Palestinian extremist terrorists, for example, that he expelled as much as, say, 10 years ago.
Right.
It's taken him longer, much longer, to come to grips with the fact that he had to make a clean start after the Lockerbie disaster, and he had to turn over the two suspects that were demanded for trial by the U.S. and the United Kingdom. It's taken him even longer to make the kind of settlement offer that he made to the families of the Lockerbie victims and to take responsibility formally at the United Nations.
Let me just turn to Mansour on what the alternative would be, because if Mansour, you're saying that the better move is to say, once a supporter of terrorist, always a supporter of terrorist. Don't change the label on the man. Aren't you in fact creating a more dangerous situation for the rest of the world, because you're not even allowing someone like Gaddafi the opportunity to demonstrate that he can change?
No, not really. You have to understand what I'm saying. I'm not saying that Libya should not have relations with the U.S. or the U.S. should not have relations with Libya. I'm not saying that. In fact, I agree with David on this issue, that it has to be very cautious. But I go back to the issue of which he brought up, the example of the Cold War, of the détente. Détente was seen differently by the United States from what the Soviet Union saw. I mean, and this is, we're in exactly the same situation over here. Libya sees this opening as different from what America sees. Now, Mr. Bush is smart. I'm not saying he was very smart, because that's exactly what the image that he wanted to portray to the nation, as one of your callers just repeated, that this is the result of our intervention in Iraq. This is the result of showing that when we're powerful, we can kick whatever it is.
So where's he wrong here?
I'm not saying he's not wrong. Mr. Bush would have been very stupid if he didn't do that. But because he was smart, he did that. But the actor here was not Mr. Bush. It's Mr. Gaddafi. It's Mr. Gaddafi who gave the bait. Mr. Gaddafi decided that he wanted to open up with the United States in 1993, not in 2003. He decided in 1993. The inhibiting factor that prevented the opening up or acquiescing to the sanctions, to the United Nations resolutions, was the fact that it held him and him only responsible, mm-hmm. that he was the primary individual behind that. He had to deflect that. And he had to deflect that only by having different changes within the United States and Britain. And they did. This 9/11 brought about a different set of changes, which removed him off the hook.
All right, let me go on to another caller here, to Cape Cod, Massachusetts. James is joining us now. Hi, James. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. Yes, great show. The question is, in hearing some of these comments and thinking about what the U.S. Has to both gain and potentially lose, plus what I'm hearing in terms of why now and what's the opportunity here for Gaddafi, do you think that the U.S. risks any further tarnishing of credibility, or someone trying to make a point in terms of saying, specifically if you talk about weapons inspections in any kind of situation that might involve that, do you think that someone might be trying to point out, if they didn't work in Iraq, why are they going to work there? If there's potential for either suspicion of programs that could be hidden, or a program in development, or weapons that are already ready to use, could that in a way almost, risk highlighting, U.S.
Inconsistencies here. Is that a concern of yours, James? Do you think that the United States is going to be called on this?
It's a concern as to whether or not a country could allow itself to be engaged in that process in order to try to highlight the fact that that the U.S. is an inconsistent policy on that, or you'd have to obviously see how it plays out before you start to speculate the outcome. But it seems like you know, well, if, you know, why would we trust that inspections with this particular leader would work when they didn't seem to be sufficient for the case in Iraq?
Ambassador Mack, this I find particularly confusing because I'm reading stories from Britain about the way that the Europeans would like to see weapons inspected, different stories from Washington about standards that the United States would set, and dismissal of Mohammed el-Baradei and his role there. Is there a simple way of helping us understand the inspection system in Libya?
Probably not.
oh,
but you know, certainly, I think it's certainly the case that international inspections can only be truly effective if other member states that have really advanced intelligence capabilities, like the United Kingdom and the United States, are working very, very closely with the international inspectors so that basically the international inspectors know what to look for. It's only when you have those inspectors on the ground that you're able to verify the kind of intelligence that you have. That you have to put the two together. I think in Iraq, it was that it was unfortunately the nature of the Iraqi regime, and also perhaps a question of international timing between the United States and its partners on the Security Council, we weren't able to put that together effectively.
This does, in effect, remove the smudge of that black eye, though,
doesn't it? I think it is an opportunity to show that you can have a different kind of approach to rolling back the specter of weapons of mass destruction proliferation. And this can be done in a way that can be replicated elsewhere in the world, hopefully in a country like North Korea someday, or Iran, other countries that one could think about. But otherwise, you're going to have countries planning to go the covert route, and that's dangerous.
Ambassador Mack has made the point, Connection listeners, that Libya stands to be held up as something of a model for a new way of dealing with leaders and states that have spotty histories when it comes to terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. Do you see it that way, and do you see things proceeding along that route that would allow it to stand as some kind of an example? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio and helping us take a look at what's happening in relations between the United States and Libya this hour. My guests are Mansour El-Kikia. He was born in Libya. He's now an American citizen, associate professor of political science at the University of Texas in San Antonio. Ambassador David Mack is also with us. He is vice president of the Middle East Institute, was ambassador to the United Arab Emirates in the mid-'80s, and deputy assistant secretary of state for Near East Affairs in the early 1990s, was actually in Libya in 1969 when Muammar Gaddafi took control in a coup in that country. Mansour El-Kikia, I'd just like to, I want to go back to our callers here, but something that I want to get your opinion on here. What do you see as the real downside for the United States in the way that it's exercising its policy in the Middle East? The U.S. marks Saddam Hussein as an evil dictator and attacks his country. The United States used to mark Muammar Gaddafi as an evil dictator, but is now finding some sort of diplomatic way of, hopefully, trying to resolve that. Is the United States in danger of being seen as inconsistent in that part of the world?
Indeed. I mean, you put your finger right on this issue, that the United States will, in fact, be seen as inconsistent. The idea that, oh, we remove Saddam Hussein, but we play ball with Gaddafi makes little sense to people watching that. Indeed, if you look at the general feelings within the Middle East, Saddam Hussein was much more liked than Gaddafi.
But Saddam Hussein never made any real gestures or overtures of peace or offerings of weapons inspection in the way that Muammar Gaddafi is.
Yeah, but that's what happens to dictators. Dictators tend to see themselves larger than life, and they don't see that they need to do that until they fall. mean, yes, Saddam Hussein was silly. He never read Clausewitz. He never read Plato. That's the problem.
He read Stalin. That may have been.
Read Stalin, yes, indeed.
Yeah, a larger problem. We're going to come back to this, but I want to make sure that we make room for our callers here.
I don't think that the United States will lose by establishing relations with Libya. On the contrary, I think the United States will gain, and I think Libya will gain as well. And this is why I come back. David is perhaps quite right. It should be conditional engagement or re-engagement. But the United States, if it's advocating changes in democracy in the Middle East, perhaps Libya can serve as a good testing ground. Yes, we will talk with you, but we want to talk with a government that is a responsible government. So, we want to talk with a government that has the institutions we can deal with.
And this is what Bush has been saying in his reluctance to normalize relations, talking about human rights and talking about other aspects of democracy in that country. Let me bring Jason in now. Jason's joining us from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Hi, Jason.
How are you? I've been listening with interest. And after 9/11... we basically told the nations of the world, either you're with us or you're against us. And Muammar Gaddafi has really felt what it means to be against us. And after seeing what we've done in Afghanistan and what we've done in Iraq, I think he said, look, you know, being against the United States and being on the wrong side of the fence is not a good thing for me or my country. And how we deal with Libya at this time with their gestures, how we ingratiate them, albeit cautiously, will send a clear message to other countries that are sitting on the fence or other countries who we've had negative dealings with in the past. And how we accept Libya will be a clear message to individuals like Fidel Castro and Kim Jong-il and North Korea and Cuba. And how we ingratiate Libya will really send a clear message to even other countries like Iran.
Jason, let me just ask you a question before we go any further, and that is, do you see any inconsistency here in the United States choosing to attack Iraq, but choosing to have this kind of engagement with Libya?
No, I don't see any inconsistency whatsoever, because Muammar Gaddafi is making the gestures. He's saying, look, we didn't go to Muammar Gaddafi. He came to us and said, look, I'm willing to come to the world table. I'm willing to reintroduce myself into the world community. And Saddam Hussein did the exact opposite. He said, well, no, I don't want weapon inspectors to look at my house here. I don't want you looking in there. You know what? I'm tired of this. Kick out the inspectors. Saddam Hussein made no attempt to join the world community. He made every attempt to keep to himself. He made every attempt to threaten the world. Whereas Muammar Gaddafi, look, he's been, since the 80s, he's been in a box. And he's basically said, look, being on the wrong side of the fence stinks, guys.
Okay, Jason, let me bring Ambassador Mack back in here, because I want to go back, Ambassador, to something you said right near the beginning of the program when you said that you weren't going to use the word trust. This wasn't a question of trusting Gaddafi. This is a question of, can you be more specific? It's a question of doing what at this point for the U.S.?
It's a question of being effective in the war against terrorism and proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. You know, there's been a lot of talk, Scott, about being consistent. Frankly, that risks being an intellectual game, and the stakes are far too great for that. I really agree with the comments that Jason, your last caller, made. I think they were just right on.
Yeah.
It's far more important that we be effective. And until you have a former state supporter of terrorism, a well-known bad government with bad leadership, until you have a government like that become relatively responsible for whatever combination of reasons, we're never going to have a chance of winning this war, because there are a lot of governments out there that are prepared to take that course if they don't see that the risks and rewards are clearly in favor of taking the responsible course and becoming a better citizen. Internationally, I'm not saying becoming perfect. I don't look for perfection. I guess I'm too old a man. I've been in doing diplomatic work for too long to expect moral perfection. After all, the Soviet Union was the most deadly enemy that the United States has faced in the last half century. Not only did we engage in this kind of conditional engagement, where on a daily basis we were talking to the Soviets, we were telling them what we expected of them, We were testing their responses. We were verifying their promises. And we did that over a period of decades, and we won the Cold War. We didn't have to go to the end and use military means to do it, even though that was always an underlying deterrent that was an important part of the mix.
Let's go to Chelmsford, Massachusetts now. Mohammed's joining us on the line from there. Hi, Mohammed.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Well, I basically say that President Bush was quite correct when he – I have 3 points to make and make them quickly. President Bush was quite correct when he linked terrorism to tyranny. If we embrace Gaddafi, our credibility will substantially suffer. I would hope that if we go with looking for weapons of mass destruction, that we also ask – for him to allow us to look into the torture chambers and the prisons. As about Gaddafi, the second point is Gaddafi is clearly baiting the U.S. to engage the U.S. because, A, he wants American investment, technology investment.
Right.
B, he wants to show the Libyans that he wants to defuse the growing resentment against him in Libya by telling them that he could engage the U.S. and he has credibility. The world will be, that's the third point and final point is, the world will be better off being healed when we have make Gaddafi answer for all his crimes, especially crimes of killing 189 of my fellow Americans in Lockerbie, he torturing and murdering thousands of Libyans. We cannot embrace a tyrant. If it looks like a duck, if it walks like a duck, it's a duck.
Mohammed, are you from that part of the world yourself?
I am from Libya, and I'm also personally impacted by Gaddafi. My brother suffers in the notorious prison, in Bouslim prison, because all he did is he called for democratic reforms. He did it in a peaceful manner, and Gaddafi is really quite offensive when he goes in yesterday in his speech, and he says that there are no prisoners of conscience in Libya, but there are vagabonds and thieves. And
okay, this guy's been in power in that country now for 34 years, but he's not a particularly old man. He could be in power for another 20 years. If you leave him in that box marked terrorist or supporter of terrorists, that means your brother's going to stay in that prison for another 20 years, doesn't it?
No, the Gaddafi does buckles under pressure. Gaddafi only understands one point is pressure and show force. That's the only thing that Gaddafi can bring Gaddafi down to his knees because he's a criminal.
You mean economic sanction force, or you mean military force, Mohammed?
Say that again?
You mean the force of economic sanctions, or do you mean the military force in terms of what he understands?
I mean the force of economic sanctions, show force, and even military force if needed to be used.
And Mansour, do you, as you listen to Mohammed describe his sense of how Gaddafi needs to be treated, do you agree with him?
I've seen it. I mean, this is what I'm saying. I'm trying to tell you, giving you a different picture.
Yeah.
The real picture is that you have a monster whose jails are still full, who does despicable things, and yet he still says, I didn't do anything. I don't have prisoners. I didn't bring down the Lockerbie. I didn't do any of that. And what bothers me even more is that the United States is buying this image. It's buying this image of this reformed, wonderful philosopher king. He's not. He's a monster.
David Mack, you have 35 years' experience as an American diplomat or in American diplomacy, and I'm wondering whether or not, as you listen to Mohammed and Mansour on this, you're thinking to yourself, you know, you can move Gaddafi to opening up his prisons if you can move him to opening up his weapons of mass destruction. What's your belief there?
Well, you know, Scott, diplomacy is the art of the possible. It's not anything for philosophers. Frankly, it's never going to satisfy poets. I happen to share the sense of outrage that my friend Mansour Kikhia and the caller feel about relatives who've been oppressed by this regime. I happen to share the sense of total disgust and outrage of the families of the Lockerbie victims.
Right.
But there are huge stakes here for our nation. The President Bush has got to look at what advances the U.S. national interest. I think that the issue is clear here. It involves not surrender to Gaddafi by any means, not rewarding him It involves setting up a structure that will modify, that will continue this behavior modification that's been going on. And I think that that's the place we've reached. I think there's been lots of times in the past, perhaps, where if we had had this mix of a determination to use force and international pressures, along with a diplomatic outlet, that we might have been able to move down this path sooner. But it certainly is timely to do it now.
I want to just go back to Mohammed in Chelmsford. Mohammed, my notes show me that you're a founding member of the Libyan American Freedom Alliance. Is that right?
That's correct.
So as you listen to Ambassador Mack talk about the greater national interest of the United States here, you must be hearing some of the point that he's making in terms of whether or not that works for or against the interests of the people who are in the prisons there.
No, I'm not convinced with that. We are an American organization, a non-government organization,
right.
And we only say that the only way for Libya to be free of weapons of mass destruction, and I put Gaddafi on the top WMD in Libya, and the only suffering will cease to exist if we bring democratic reforms to Libya. Libya has to be, we've lived for 34 years under tyranny. Gaddafi cannot change his colors. Gaddafi has created an institution of wickedness. That institution of wickedness must be cleansed, must be totally cleansed. We cannot deal with this. Our credibility, the security of the U.S. is far more important for us to be playing games. We have to look for long-term fruits, not short-term ones.
All right. Mohammed, I want to interrupt you there and get a last word from Mansour El-Kiki, if I can. Mansour, if you were to put the next words into the president's mouth, what would you have him saying to Gaddafi right now?
Mr. Gaddafi, change your regime. Mr. Gaddafi, open up your country. That should be the cost for opening up relations with him. We don't need him. He needs us.
Thanks so much for being with us on the program today.
Mansour
El-Kiki is a Libyan dissident, associate professor of political science at the University of Texas in San Antonio. Ambassador David Mack, I want to thank you for your time.
It was a pleasure, Dick.
Ambassador Mack is now vice president with the Middle East Institute. Mohammed, thank you very much for your call. Earlier in the program, we heard from Scott Anderson, who profiled Gaddafi for the New York Times magazine. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.